been quite a while since I gave a talk here at the Dhammaloka Center. In the middle of last August was the last talk I gave here since then. The other month, been on a retreat. But sometimes, even though we might go on a retreat, arrange a retreat for 3 months, sometimes there's still a lot of work goes on. Sometimes people don't really understand what goes on in the monastery. It's all the physical work, administration work, pastoral work, which still has to go on. But even so that I managed to have a wonderful 2 weeks. So, out and out retreat, just by myself. And it just reinforces the understanding just how necessary it is for everyone in this world to have time to stop. To have time for yourself. To have time to be by yourself. To have time for silence. Otherwise, life becomes far too confusing. The whole idea of meditation, as it is the central theme in the Buddhist practice, is in order for people to understand for themselves what's going on. And one of the reasons why so many people cannot understand for themselves is the confusion which reigns inside the mind. It's one of the first things a person sees when they start to meditate. Not peace, not bliss, but just confusion. Just how fast do these thoughts go? And just how meaningless most of them are. They never seem to lead anywhere. They never seem to give a real solution to any problem. At least no solution which really stands the test of time. Sometimes we can think our way out of a problem, but then another problem comes up afterwards. And sometimes we can't even find our way out of just the ordinary problems in life. And it is such a shame that we live, especially in this day and age, in a society which does not encourage stopping. People haven't even got the patience to stop at a red traffic light. We get angry instead, wishing that red traffic light to change as soon as possible. Just last Wednesday, or just a little bit earlier, sorry, perhaps a week ago, I went in with a fellow monk. I'm going to confuse myself now. I was with one of the lay people staying at the monastery to get a picture framed. And once the fellow was asking, well, when do you want the picture framed? Suppose you want it as soon as possible. He said, no. And they did a double take. What do you mean, not as soon as possible? I was ordering some equipment for the monastery. And again, the same thing happened. Oh, I suppose you want it the next couple of days. And I told him, it was actually a stonemason jar. I told him, no, just whenever you're ready. And he smiled. He smiled because it was so unusual for someone to go into his shop and say, no, I don't need it yesterday. Take your time. What a terrible, terrible rush we are in our lives. And how often can we say, well, even though I've got many, many things to do, even though there's so much on my plate, now I'm going to leave it all aside and rest. I like to use the simile of a garden because many people in this culture have little gardens in their backyard. Have you got a garden? In the past week, have you enjoyed your garden? Have you gone out there and just sat in the back and done absolutely nothing? Just to enjoy the fruit of all that labour and time and effort and money you put into your garden? Or is it the only time you go into your garden is to work? You go into the garden to mow the lawn, to prune the flowers, to water it, to prune it, to put fertilizer on it. What are you doing it for? Don't you deserve, having put all that time and effort into your garden, don't you deserve just half an hour a week, a day, just to sit there And just to watch the, as I say, watch the trees grow. Have you ever watched a tree grow? The reason why you never see a tree grow is you're not patient enough. Trees are lovely because they grow so slowly. So you need to sit there a long time with your attention on the tree before you see any difference. The point is that so often we do not stop. All of our time, whether it's work, whether it's rest, whether it's meditation, is doing something. Working, making, achieving. We're always going somewhere. We're never where we are. And that's why life becomes so confusing. We never know what it's like to be where we are. So if you have a garden in the back of your house, to try for an experiment, say, can you make half an hour a week? How about at least 15 minutes to go in there and just sit. Get a nice comfy chair, not with a book, not with a radio, and just sit there and see what happens. You're sitting there in the chair thinking, Ajahn Brahm told me just to sit here and do nothing. And I'm sure after 1 or 2 minutes you start feeling guilty of all the things you're supposed to be doing, the dirty dishes on the sink, the telephone calls you have to do. And you start looking at the garden and see that really needs pruning, that needs watering. If you're really going to rest, you have to say, stop. Enough. The garden will never be finished unless you say it is. The dishes will never all be washed up. The house will never all be cleaned. The monastery will never all be built. All your duties and responsibilities will never be fulfilled. If you want to get all of that out of the way before you stop, you'll die first. It'll get you out of the way first. So it's very, very important in our lives to take time to stop. And when I say stop, I mean stopping, really stopping, doing nothing. And then when we can do nothing, this is what we call meditation. This is what we call like emptying the mind out so we can see clearly what's going on. We're always thinking about what needs to be mown, what needs to be pruned, what needs to be watered. We're never actually experiencing the beauty of the garden. Actually, you can see what's that. We're seeing all the faults in the garden, aren't we? That's too dry. That plant is too long. That bush is too weak. It obviously needs some more fertilizer. We're always seeing the faults in our garden. That's why we always have to work. So instead of watching the faults, instead of always having to do something, part of the beauty of meditation is learning how to stop and see what's already there. To appreciate the beauty which is already there in your garden. And to spend some time with it. To be with it. This is a wonderful attitude because it does help solve many of the problems in our lives. It may sound to you a very simple exercise. It may even seem to some people just copping out. There's so much to be done in the world. There's so many problems. There's people are hurting so much. How can you just sit in the garden for half an hour? That's just being so selfish. Think of it. All the problems in the world. All the problems in your life. Just even though that the last 3 months I've supposed to spend most of the time in the monastery, I don't know how many funerals I've been to in the last 3 months, or visiting hospitals for people who are about to go to a funeral. I'll see them again later soon. To see people ringing up with desperate troubles, it's one of the, you might call it benefits. It's not very pleasant, but when people are in trouble, they ring you up. They want you to come round, if it's to do some counselling, to do some chanting, to conduct these funerals and rites of passage. And as a monk, you do see things which, as an ordinary lay person, you will never see. You see deeper into the hearts of many, many people, and you see some of the pain which is there, the desperate pain, the agony of grief, and the confusion of losing someone who's just still so young. Why? This, at this moment now, how many people are in hospitals in agony? This moment in Perth. How many people are dying their last moments? How many people are just with their husband, their wife, their child, who's just about to pass away? How many people are just in pain? How many people are suffering in this world at this moment? How many people are in the torture chambers, just screaming out for their mothers? How many people are just dying of hunger? How many people are being shot and killed? These are all the problems in the world. How can you just sit down and meditate? What use is that? People will say. It has a tremendous use. I remember vividly a few years ago being invited to a peace vigil just opposite Hay Street now. For the situation in Burma, it was a time when there was terrible riots in the streets of Rangoon where many people, including monks, were being killed. And the idea of the vigil was to sit meditation on the concrete steps just outside of a very busy part of Perth. And I remember vividly, just as I started sitting there, absolutely still, a passerby commenting, "A lot of bloody good that will do." Excuse me for the language, that's what he said. And I thought afterwards that that fellow was wrong. That actually stopping does a great deal of good to help and solve the problems in the world. And it's because that people do not stop, do not rest, do not stand back and consider what's going on, that these problems originate in the first place. Look at your own life. Why do you get angry? Why do you shout at other people? Why do you feel bad about yourself? But one of the main reasons why one gets angry at oneself or others is just because you are tired. You are so tired of just the busyness of life that one other person just lays one more difficulty on you and says, "I can't stand anymore," and you shout and get upset. Are you overburdened in life? Have you got space to allow one more fool to come and wreck your day? It'd be very easy, wouldn't it, if we're living in an office, or so working in an office, where we've got time, and if someone just rings us up at the wrong time or they make a mistake, a silly mistake, which is really stupid, they shouldn't have made. We can accept that if we've got the time, if we feel rested, if we're not doing much else. But if we're overburdened, if we're tired, we have so many things to do in our day, and just one more person just makes a mistake, and we have to sort it all out, take up more of our time, that's often when we get angry. We get angry because of this horrible, insidious tiredness within our minds. You can try it. If one ever goes to, say, do a long period of meditation, such as a meditation retreat, if one really calms the mind down, if one really rests, and then someone comes and calls you an idiot, a fool, stupid, or whatever, if they do a stupid mistake and create so many more problems for you, it doesn't matter. When you're rested, you can take that without any problems. Also, not just the essential state of your inner being, the rested state, the state of ease inside of us, but also that the understanding which comes from stopping. When you stop and just look in your garden, when you just rest there, you start to see things which you never were looking for. Whenever we're working, we're just looking in one direction. Again, we're looking for what needs to be fixed up. When we're resting, we're seeing the whole picture. The beauty which is already there, as well as the faults, but we don't just dwell on the faults, we see the whole picture. And we see the whole nature when we stand back and be still. It's like the old simile of a lake. The simile of a lake is a very profound simile in Buddhist meditation. Because a lake which has got ripples on its surface is something which reflects the sky. If you look upon a lake, most lakes which are disturbed with waves or ripples, they look blue, white or grey, depending on the sky. We all know if you just take a handful of that water, the lake hasn't got any colour whatsoever. The lake is transparent. It takes on that colour because of the reflection of something outside of it completely. When our minds are not still, when there's ripples inside of us, when we haven't stopped, All that we can see, we can't see into the depths at all. What we do see is nothing to do with our mind. It's just a reflection of what's outside. It's not ours. It's not our inner being. It's external to us. We can never understand ourselves, our relationships, our relationship to the world outside, until we are still. Until we stop. Until we rest. And it's amazing to see understanding which can come up when the mind does become silent. When all of this noise of thinking and commenting and criticizing, all the doing and the business of our lives ceases, then we see. It's as if all of that noise is static on a radio. It's as if it's grease and dirt on the windscreen. It stops us from seeing clearly. That's why in the Buddhist tradition it's so important to take time to be still, to quiet the mind, so we can start to understand what is going on. If we don't understand what is going on, it's as if we're a blind person. We walk through this world stumbling over one another. We have no intention to hit one another, but because we can't see, we just barge into one another. We fall over the chairs and the cushions. And we get so bruised in our life. Have you been bruised? Why? The main reason why is because of not understanding. Not understanding what's going on. I was talking on Tuesday night in Armidale about just the relationships between a man and a woman, which cause a lot of trouble if they're not understood properly. If one really looks carefully at any relationship, one sees one of its main characteristics is the uncertainty and permanence. We meet one another only to eventually have to part. Our time together is limited. Now, when I first said that, down at Armidale on Tuesday night, someone objected, well, are you just encouraging people to get divorced? See? I said, no, that's not how it works. Be still and look what that really means. What it really means is the same as the simile of a glass, which Ajahn Chah always used to like using. He used to hold up a glass and say, this glass is impermanent. This glass will someday shatter. If you realize that it isn't made out of unbreakable material, what is the result of that realization? The result of that realization is that you look after the glass. You are careful for it because you know it's fragile. If that was made out of unbreakable glass or plastic, then I wouldn't matter about it. I'd just kick it around. It's not fragile. Why bother about it? Once you realize that something is fragile, it can break very, very easily, it's then that you really look after it. It's because people do not realize that their relationships are fragile. They fall in love, get married, and think, I'm going to live happily ever after, because that's what it says in a fairy tale. They don't look after the relationship. They don't put any more effort into it. They've got married and think that's it, they don't need to do any more. Once one realizes the fragility in a relationship, then one will always be putting forth effort, care, into how one speaks, how one relates, what one does with the other person. One always knows that this isn't going to last, I'd better look after it. And also when, even though one does one's best, eventually when it does break, eventually when the glass does break, you're prepared. You know about it. So often it has happened when I've gone to funerals that people have never prepared themselves for the death of someone close to them. That is why they cry. That is why they suffer. That is what causes so much grief and upset and pain in people's hearts. They never prepared themselves. They never accepted the possibility. They never stopped to reflect on what the life was really about. It's only when we do stop, and again, sometimes at funerals, that really stops people, not just the fellow in the coffin, but the other people around, they stop and think. The business of their life ceases for that half an hour when they're in the chapel. And they listen. They listen with their heart. to what's going on. So it's very important to be able to stop and to cease doing things so we can see clearly what we should be doing. But many of these things which we say about stopping and seeing, we see some little things, but they're really what we might call like band-aid solutions to our life. They sort of tend to fix things up and prop things up. We can, if we have worldly wisdom, be able to live a decent relationship with another person. We can learn to live a decent relationship with ourselves. We can eat the right foods and live a long time. But I mean, in the end, what have you got left? There is such a great deal of pain in this world. There is a great deal of suffering, and we are liable to it. We can try and prop up this body, we can try and prop up these relationships, we can try and prop up this life. But it's in my few years I've seen enough suffering to realize that the basic human predicament, our lives, no matter how clever or wise or diligent we are, we're going to cop it. But sometimes that people, again, in great suffering, ask, why is it that way? Why is there so much suffering in this world? Again, my first encounter with religion was probably just asking my father if he believed in God. And his answer, which I also remember, was to say no. A definite no, and his reason why was that he'd seen so much suffering in the world, he could never ever believe in a God. And he was just someone who'd gone through the Second World War. And he'd never told what suffering he saw. I never asked him. Well, I said I did ask him, but he would never say. Why? The problem with the suffering in this world, the problem with the terrible troubles which are in this world, let's not sort of hide our face. Let's not sort of deny its existence. The potential trouble and problem of life and death and sickness and people exploiting one another, torturing one another. Why is it that way and what can we do about it? The reason why it is this way is because it is the very nature of the human existence, the way we are. We will keep on going, exploiting one another, hurting one another, torturing one another. Because of our, the Buddha kept on saying, because of the tendencies in our mind to be selfish, to be greedy, to have anger. Whenever our desires are frustrated, we get anger because of our tiredness, because of not seeing clearly. And this is the nature of most human beings in this world. So what do you expect? Would you be able to do much better if you were Prime Minister of Australia or President of the United States? I often used to think I could do much better, but now I sometimes wonder. The nature of human beings, what is it? If the chips were really down and it was your child, would you kill another person for him? Would you get angry at someone who was torturing another person? What would you really do, to be honest with yourself? Our human condition has got these tendencies within it, these conditioned tendencies of greed, selfishness, desire, protecting just our friends. This is what the world is made out of. What do you expect? So often that one of the, what I have always found a tremendous way to open up the problem of suffering, to get some really decent answers to what the real problem is always to ask that question myself. Well, what do you expect? What do you expect of other people? What do you expect of people in jail? What do you expect of people in wars? What do you expect of having, what do you expect of a glass, but it must break? What do you expect of this life? I know that Mark Twain once said that Life would be wonderful if we were born at 80 years old and then got younger every day and died when we were 18 or 16 or something. Wouldn't life be wonderful? It's not like that though, is it? We get older every day. We get older, we get sicker. We get sicker, we get more painful in our bodies. Our people we like and we love, they can be taken away from us at any time. And we live in a wonderful world. Australia, no wars, no terrorists. Imagine what it's like for other people born in other lands. This is our predicament. And so even though we can have band-aid solutions, we can try and increase the understanding towards one another, the tolerance towards one another, we can even become a bit more peaceful towards one another. Would other people become more peaceful towards us? So often that when I have talked here about peace and acceptance and kindness and love and tolerating the people around you, some people have come back and said, that's all very well, but what's it like when someone else just harangues you and gives you such a hard time, when they're physically abusive to you, when they're hitting you, when they're even torturing you? Even though the Buddha did say once that even if people hold you down and saw you limb from limb with a two-handed saw, you should not feel any anger towards those people torturing you. And could you do that? So what are we going to do is the problem. This is the problem. How are we going to understand this and do something about it? And the Buddha was saying the only real way out of this problem is not to get born again. If we get born into a human life, this is what we can expect. Why is it that we keep getting reborn? Now sometimes, to go on a little sidetrack on getting reborn, sometimes people who come here, even though this is a Buddhist society and the Buddha talked again about rebirth, sometimes people object about the very idea of rebirth and can't accept the fact of rebirth. And it's very interesting, it's always very interesting to contemplate why it is that people do not accept the possibility even of rebirth. Why is it that people actually believe in no rebirth? That's a very, very solid belief. And the point is there are many people alive today who can remember their past lives. And those memories can be checked up. And those memories, when they are checked up, there's no way that they could have had that information from any other source. Those people remember their past lives. If one person remembers their past lives, what about us? If one person's been reborn, isn't it so that surely every other being has been reborn? Why just one or two or three and not everyone? Imagine if that is actually true, there is such a thing as rebirth, being born and born and born again and again and again. What are we being reborn into? This life of coming into a womb and having to learn all over again, forgetting all that we ever learned before. Sometimes I have thought, wouldn't it be nice just to be magic back to 18, 19 years of age again? Whatever age you would really like, with all your wisdom and knowledge, so you really know what to do. Unfortunately, when we're reborn, we forget all we've ever learned. We have to start all over again. And when we're reborn and start all over again, it's painful to learn, to keep falling over, to keep having to put our hand in the fire once more to find out it burns and it hurts. And that's why the Buddha once said, it's actually a little sutta which enlightened many monks when he said that in all of the times you've been dying and being reborn, dying and being reborn, dying and being reborn, he said that the blood which has flown from your head being cut off is more than all the water in all the earth. We think this lifetime, but over many lifetimes. Do you think we can really escape from all these? Do you really want to go through all this again? Why is it that we keep on getting reborn? The main reason why we keep on getting reborn, the Buddha said, was because of we haven't really understood the problem. We haven't had enough time to be still to really see clearly what's going on. In fact, the reason why we don't believe in rebirth is the reason why we don't believe in the essential nature of the human being is because we don't want to. I've seen that people will only believe what's comfortable for them to believe. What fits in to your ideas, which you've worked out, which is comfortable, which suits you, which makes you feel okay. And that's why sometimes I've noticed myself coming up here, giving a talk, and watering down Buddhism, because that's what people would like. Sometimes a very popular speaker can come up here and say, we don't really need to do very much to be happy and to be at ease. You are really okay in yourself, don't you really need to do very much? Sometimes a person from maybe, I don't know, the Zen religion is sometimes like this, sometimes they come up and say, you're already enlightened, you don't need to try. Unfortunately, that sounds very good. It's just saying, well, you're okay, you don't need to change, you don't need to do anything. Just be yourself. That sounds very comfortable because it's like someone patting us on the back saying, you're alright, you don't need to do anything. You don't need to do any more work. Unfortunately, that's not true. Unfortunately, we have got a problem in our lives. Even there may not be the problem right at this very moment for us, the life may be quite sweet and comfortable. The point is, the potential is there. It has been in our past, and it will be in the future, to have intense suffering and distress. Intense. And again, think at this very moment how many people are experiencing that intense pain and suffering. It's not pleasant, but this is the reality of our life. When Buddhism first came to the West, people used to criticize Buddhism as being pessimistic. It's realistic. We have a problem. The Buddha kept on saying it's the wheel of samsara, which goes round and round and round and round. We keep getting crushed under the rim. We have fun for a moment as we get to the top of the wheel, and then we go down again. Happiness and pain, happiness and pain, happiness and pain. Sometimes people will think, well, it's okay to have a little bit of pain if you can have happiness as well. If you can have maybe just a little bit more happiness and pain, then pain is really worth it. After a while, you get sick of the truth. Sure, there must be something else than being subject to this disappointment, frustration, physical pain, mental pain. Of course, one of the first reasons why people don't see this is because they think it's their fault. They think it's my fault that my son died. It's my fault that the marriage didn't last. It's my fault that I'm sick. I just didn't eat the right food. It's my fault I didn't pass the exam because I didn't study hard enough. Thinking we can always prop up this old house which is falling down. Thinking we can prop up this world and keep it going. Ever and ever and ever and ever. If we can only just talk some sense into these governments, we can get this environment right. We can get the economy right. We can get our marriage right. We can fix up the car as long as we get a good mechanic. We all know with a car that you can only keep it going for a while. When it gets old, it's going to get old and old and old and old. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. When we realize that this is the very nature, unavoidable nature of a glass is to break. Not a mistake. You can't really blame anyone for knocking it over when it breaks. You can blame its nature. When we understand it's the nature of a relationship to eventually cease. It's the nature of the body to get sick. It's the nature of our hopes to be disappointed. Then we begin to see something. We begin to see that something which lies behind all of our difficulties and suffering and problems. We really begin to see the why. What's going on here? For many, many years, for many lifetimes, we might have thought it was somebody else's fault, or it was my fault. Blame the husband, blame the government, blame the teachers, blame the parents. We're all passing the buck. Even blame God. as I think my father did. That doesn't solve the problem. Because when we blame someone else, it's as if we can only talk some sense into them, we can fix up. We can have like a utopian Earth. Maybe even like a utopian Australia. Or maybe even just a utopian Perth or a utopian Buddhist society. Have a Buddhist monastery. Well, at least there, everything is beautiful. All this is flowers and beautiful trees and beautiful buildings and beautiful monks who always smile and give lovely talks and never say a bad word. That's not the reality of life, is it? The monastery is tremendously difficult to keep up and maintain. It's already falling to bits. Just at the end of the range retreat, I was shocked at just how much maintenance work needs to be done. Because the three ones, we weren't doing very much. It's how much work needs to be done in the forest just to keep it from being overrun by weeds, which it is after the fire. And sometimes, as Jacob was saying today, sometimes it seems almost hopeless trying to look after the monastery. That's the nature of a monastery, to be hopeless. That's what it's there for us to see. This is what our relationships are supposed to be teaching us. This is what the pain in our body is supposed to be teaching us. This is what the disappointments in our lives, not just the ordinary little disappointments of maybe not winning the lotto this week, but the deep disappointments of having people die around you. Of having your whole world just crumble to bits. The deep disappointments are teaching us something. They're teaching us that this is part of our life. Once we see this, and when we ask, what do we expect? The answer, I expect justice. I have a body, I expect pain. I expect sickness. I have this human body, I expect death. I expect disappointment. I expect frustration. I expect many things in this life not to go my way. How that changes life. How that understanding gives this. It's like this, there's a statue in a monastery in the south of Thailand with this person just holding up his hands like this. Happiness at last. To know there's no joy in the world. Because all the time the problem is we're fighting that which cannot be changed. We're desperately being angry at ourselves, another person. We're being angry at life. I saw once a monk who was trying to sew a robe and the needle got stuck in the sewing machine and he got that sewing machine and he whacked it against the, you stupid machine, you stupid machine, you stupid machine. Was it the sewing machine's fault? It's the nature of sewing machines to go wrong. It's the nature of your car to go wrong. And it seems to be, just from statistical inference, its nature is to go wrong just when you really need it. Isn't that life? Whose fault is it? When we don't blame ourselves, when we don't blame our husband, our wife, our kids, our parents, when we don't blame our government, when we don't blame, when there's no one else to blame, not even ourselves, what do you think would happen? When we stop blaming, we realize, this is our life. This is the way it is. The glass breaks, it's no one's fault. That gives us this great understanding, this great peace, realizing what is really going on, what is the nature of our life. This comes from stillness. And we don't get frustrated at being frustrated. We don't get angry at being angry. We don't get sick about being sick. We can actually start to really allow these things to be, allow life to be. And again, just with the glass, even though I will allow this glass to break when it breaks, and I will not feel unhappy about it, even though the Buddhist society who owns this glass might blame me, but the nature of this glass, because it is fragile, I look after it. Because my body is subject to pain, I will look after it. Because the people I meet, the people I talk to, the people I live with are subject to pain. I will care for them. Can you see how the understanding of the noble truth of suffering is not a negative, pessimistic understanding, but the realism makes our life much more careful. We put much more energy into our life, into our moments. When we realize just how fragile this life is, we cannot be careless. When we realize how fragile a relationship is with another person, we cannot afford even one word of anger. We cannot even afford just one moment of taking the other person for granted. Our relationship is that fragile. The person was lonely up last week, had a separation from his wife. Once he had that separation, it really knocked some sense into him to really understand his relationship with that other person and to care for it and look after the other person. You see, so often we just take one another. It means you become very alive indeed. Every moment counts. Sometimes the people can think that just what a burden that is to have to keep putting forth this effort in life. It's no more a burden than waking up in the morning and getting out of bed. We are asleep. Asleep being that so many moments of our day aren't with 400% being, living. One experiences when one starts to put full attention in whatever one is doing, one starts to experience this wonderful feeling of being alive, of aliveness, of being awake. Every moment one is right there. Every moment one knows what one is doing. The Buddha used to call this mindfulness, awakeness, living, being, careful. The most important person is that which is right there before you. The most important task is that which you are doing. Someone told me that many years ago, a Westerner went up to see Ajahn Chah in the monastery at Wat Nong Phapong in the north of east of Thailand. Ajahn Chah was very busy with other people. And so this Westerner who'd gone all that way didn't have a chance to speak with Ajahn Chah. And so that he left the gathering there, and the other monk was trying to tidy up the monastery. And so the other monks had got the brooms and were sweeping leaves off the path of the monastery. So he decided, well, he'd come all this way anyway, he might as well do something useful. He took hold of the broom and started sweeping the path. He'd only been sweeping the path a few minutes when Ajahn Chah left his hut. He was going off to another monastery. He saw this Westerner who'd come all this way, and he went up to him. He didn't have time to give him a long discourse. And so he put his hand on this Westerner's shoulder and said, if you're sweeping, sweep with all your effort and attention. And then Ajahn Chah left and went away. That man told me secondhand that that was the most profound teaching he'd ever got in his life. In that circumstance, just a few words, Ajahn Chah had really hit him on the head. If you're sweeping, sweep with all your effort and all your attention. If you're meditating, meditate with all your effort and all your attention. If you are vacuuming the carpet, vacuum with all your effort and all your attention. If you are talking to someone on the telephone, with all your effort and all your attention. They are the most important person in the world. Now is the most important time. The most important thing to do, care. That's what care means. Full attention, full being. That's not so impossible to achieve. It awakes one, it brings this feeling of joy and energy into one's life, and it also starts to bring forth the care and the wisdom. So one does look after the fragile grass. One does care for the relationship. One does avoid as much as possible the inherent suffering of our lives. One is awake. One is wise. One is caring. This is just a little talk this evening on some of the things of which Buddhism teaches. I started off by talking about stopping so we can rest and so we can see. I did dwell a lot on the suffering which is inherent in this world, which should be the impetus for us to do something about our problem. It should be that which encourages us to take time off, to stop, to see, to understand. And once we understand the deep problems of our life, the fragility and vulnerability, the anicca, the impermanence and uncertainty of our very existence, whether it's a relationship, or whether it's having a body, or whether it's having a job, once we know just how uncertain it all is, then we care. We look after. We don't take things so much for granted anymore. And we can accept also the problems and difficulties and the suffering which does come in our lives. We don't blame other people, we don't blame ourselves. We see this as part of the fabric of existence. And we become alive. We become at peace. And this is what I would wish for all of us here today, that we can understand and come to a sense of peace with our lives. Personally, I've seen enough suffering in myself and in other people. And so much of that suffering is avoidable. So much of that suffering is from this misunderstanding our lives. It's avoidable. Please avoid it. So, is there any questions about the talk I've given this evening? Or comments? Or complaints?